Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Meghna Chakrabarty, my co-host, is off today. Damian Echols spent 18 years on Arkansas's death row for a crime he says he did not commit. In 1994, an Arkansas jury convicted him and two other men who became known as the West Memphis Three for the murder of 3 8-year-old boys. The case against them was controversial, and according to many, it was flawed. It featured a botched investigation, a coerced confession, allegations of jury tampering, and allegations of satanic rituals. And years after their conviction, DNA testing failed to link the three to evidence at the crime scene, and pressure grew to free them. In 2011, after almost 2 decades in jail, they were released in a complicated deal that fell short of full exoneration. Damian Echols now lives in Salem, north of Boston. He wrote a book last year called Life After Death, which will be the subject of a conversation tonight at the MIT Media Lab, moderated by our own Bob Oakes. And Damian Echols joins me right now in Studio 3. Welcome to Radio Boston. Very good to have you.
Thank you for having me.
I want to ask you about this dramatic transition from being locked up in prison for almost 20 years on death row. We often hear these stories of wrongful convictions, in many cases of exonerations. We're left with this idea that the story is over. It ended happily. You were unfairly put in jail. Now you're out. You're free. Hooray, the story's over. But what is it like reentering the world after so much time being locked away?
To say it's traumatizing would be a huge understatement. You know, whenever you get out, people think you're just going to be happy and excited because you're out of prison. And you are, but at the same time, the anxiety and the stress and everything else that comes along with it is literally crippling. Yeah. I was in a state of deep shock and trauma for at least 6 months after I got out. I couldn't do anything by myself, for myself. You have to keep in mind, not only was I in prison for more than 18 years, I was in solitary confinement for almost the last decade before I got out. So whenever I went out, I went from almost 10 years of solitary confinement to just being thrust out into humanity. And it just, it ruptures you.
And be specific, because we throw words like this around in the general population, solitary confinement. I think people sort of understand what that means, but maybe not. What does that specifically mean?
You are, in essence, sealed inside a concrete vault for 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The technical stance, the exact wording they use, is that you're in solitary 23 hours a day and you're allowed 1 hour out. Well, what they mean by out is you're taken out of your cell and put into another cell. The only difference being that there's no toilet or television in the cell where you get your what they call yard call for the day. But you're in a cell 24 hours a day. It's part of what destroyed my vision. I wasn't exposed to sunlight for almost 10 years. The only people you really come in contact with are people who want to hurt you, prison guards. If they want to come in and destroy your cell, retaliate against you for something, that's the only people that you're around.
I've read that when you got out, from what you're describing, once you got out, it sounds like sensory overload almost when you're out here in the world on the outside.
Sensory overload in every sense, you know, in sight and hearing and taste and smell and texture. You're taking in so much that it's almost like it paralyzes you. I went from almost 10 years of solitary confinement to the streets of New York City, Manhattan. So it was from one extreme to the other. And even though it's overwhelming, it feels like you're starving at the same time, that you're finally getting this energy, this human interaction, this connection with other people that you've missed, that you've needed for so long. It's finally filling a void. And I would go out and walk the streets of New York almost 24 hours a day. I would walk until I was so exhausted, I was stumbling over my own feet, just because it was so glorious.
Now, in order to be released, your lawyers struck a deal with the state of Arkansas, something called an Al Ford plea, in which you maintain your innocence but also plead guilty, after which you're sentenced for time served and released. So it fell short of a full exoneration. Why that deal? Why did you accept that deal?
to be honest, I was dying. You know, there's not much medical care, much dental care on death row. They're not going to spend a lot of time and money and energy taking care of someone they plan on killing. There were times whenever I got so sick, I literally didn't think I was going to make it through the night. A lot of my teeth had nerve damage from being hit in the face, and I was in a lot of pain. There are no caps, no crowns, no root canals. It's mm-hmm. live in pain or let them pull your teeth out. I hadn't seen sunlight in 10 years. I had been eating garbage just to stay alive. My health was failing very rapidly. Not only that, but we also did a documentary, and the prosecutor does an interview in the documentary, and he says his number one priority in this case was the fact that me and the other two guys they had convicted could collectively sue the state for $60 million, and it was his job to make sure that didn't happen. You know, I got to keep in mind, they can have me stabbed to death for a pack of cigarettes or $50 any day of the week. Mm. Stuff like that happens in prison all the time. And nobody thinks twice about it. I knew if I did not take this deal, one way or another, I was never going to live to see the outside of those walls.
But now, these days, you're still pushing for full exoneration.
Absolutely.
You're out. You're a free man. Why is that so important to you?
Because I still have this curse hanging over my head. You know, I want to be exonerated. I want the person who belongs in prison in prison. And we want the public officials who did this to us held accountable for what they've done. The only way that's going to happen is if we keep talking about it, if we keep it front and center. You know, the reason I'm out right now, it's not because they found new DNA. It's not because new eyewitnesses came forth. It's because they realized people were watching them. People were paying attention to what they were doing. If not for that, they would have still killed me and swept us under the rug. To this day, the state of Arkansas has never had an exoneration. They still maintain, the attorney general, in the briefs he files, says the state of Arkansas has never sent an innocent person to prison. So it's going to be a long, hard, uphill fight to get those things overturned, to get them to answer for those things. Mm. But still, we're not going to stop until it happens.
According to the Innocence Project, DNA testing has led to the release of more than 300 people who were wrongfully convicted, including people on death row. And in a lot of these cases, we see the same defects of the criminal justice system. Forced confessions, faulty eyewitness testimony, even prosecutors who refuse to admit they were wrong, even when DNA testing points to another suspect. And it seems to me that maybe not all of these, but some of these were elements in your case as well, some of these defects.
Absolutely. You know, a lot of people, whenever they hear about false confessions, people still to this day say they don't believe there's any such thing. They
right.
say, why would someone confess to something they didn't do? Well, the answer is you can torture someone until they confess to anything. It's just like the witch trials that happened here in Salem. You can put enough pressure on someone that they will break and admit to all kinds of things they didn't do just to make it stop.
Mm, yeah. Now, your story is the subject of, you mentioned the documentary called West of Memphis, which you and your wife, Laurie Davis, co-produced. You had some big-time help from Peter Jackson and Fran Walsh, who made the Lord of the Rings movies. Why did you decide to be a part of that project? And I'm asking this because in one sense, I've got to believe you want to put all of this behind you.
Well, at the time we started this project, this was a couple of years before a ruling had been made in the case where the Supreme Court said they were finally going to hear the new evidence. Mm. At the time we'd started to make this documentary, we had new DNA evidence. We had new eyewitnesses. We had new forensic experts. Well, when we presented them to the judge in our case, he refused to hear it. He said, mm-hmm. no, it doesn't matter. I'm not going to hear this. This case is over. So he was still going to murder me, even with all the new evidence we had. So Peter Jackson says, well, then, if we can't get this evidence heard in court, let's at least get it out to the public so that people see what's happening. And that's whenever we decided to make this documentary. At the time that we started making it, the case was sort of dead in the water. There wasn't a lot of media attention coming to it. Things had started to die down a little. So this was our way. When you watch this movie, when you watch this documentary, in essence, what you're watching is what we would have presented had we went to court.
It's fascinating. I have to ask you, during those 18 years in jail, all those years in solitary confinement on death row in Arkansas, how did you keep your hope alive that this hell would end? Did you think it would end? But how did you stay sane?
It was two things. What it all comes down to is my wife, Lori, who we've been together for 18 years now, and we built a world, a life for ourselves, even in that hellish situation. Mm. The other was my spiritual practice. You know, for the first 2 to 3 years that I was on death row, I would wake up furious in the morning. Your first thought is, these people have no right to do this to me. I'm not supposed to be here. And that kind of anger eats you alive. In Buddhism, there's a quote, they say, holding on to anger like that is like drinking poison in hopes that it'll kill the other person. Mm. It doesn't happen. It doesn't hurt anybody but you. So I knew I had to find some way to let go of that. And that's what led me to meditation.
Are you still angry?
Not really anymore, no. Life is, there's too much to enjoy in life. There's too many great things out there, too much to be part of, to sit and think about the past. Eventually, over the years, while I was on death row, I received ordination in the Rinzai Zen tradition of Japanese Buddhism. It was the same tradition that used to train the samurai in ancient Japan. That and my wife were what got me through those years.
I have to imagine that talking about this and talking again about it and being asked about it by people like me is difficult. I mean, on the one hand, you want to push the case for your exoneration, but on the other, I have to imagine that it's the last thing you want to be reminded of day after day after day, what you went through.
Absolutely. I always tell people, imagine the worst thing that's ever happened to you in your life and then having to talk about it over and over. But at the same time, if I don't keep talking about it, the state of Arkansas is never going to do the right thing. We have to let them know we're not going to go away. So I have to sort of find a balance. I have to find a way to move on with my life, to do what I enjoy, to do what I'm passionate about, while at the same time keeping up this fight.
Well, you mentioned moving on. As we mentioned, you're married. You now live in Salem. 3 years after your release, is your life anything close to normal? Does it feel like the life that you want?
Actually, I've only been out a year and 8 months.
A year and 8 months.
Excuse me. It's getting a little more normal every day. Tonight is our last big stop on the book tour, and we're going to go back to as close as we get to a normal life. A few weeks ago, I actually opened up an office in Salem where I teach meditation classes and energy work, things that I'm passionate about, that I love doing, completely outside the case. And that's what I'm looking forward to going back to now. Eventually, that's what I'd just look forward to going to on a daily basis, being able to put my energy into.
Well, Damien Eccles spent 18 years on death row in Arkansas. He lives in Salem now. He's the author of Life After Death. He'll be at the MIT Media Lab tonight at 6, talking with our own Bob Oakes. There's a lot more information about that and about his story at RadioBoston.org. Damien Eccles, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And stay with us. Coming up, the roots and reasoning behind the popular rallying cry, Boston Strong. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.